I'm Will Harris, and today's program has been brought to you by White Oak Pastures.
Hi, this is The Naturalist. This is Carol Butler.
And Bernie Wides.
And we are back talking some more about zoos. Bernie had an anecdote about the Bronx Zoo that we left out of the first show. Did you want to start with that?
Which one was that?
About the hoax?
The hoax. Yeah, that's the Central Park Zoo.
Central Park, sorry.
Yeah. Okay, our last show we dealt with parks in the city. We have four zoos in the city and maybe five. There's one on Staten Island that nobody knows much about, but it's out there. So in 1874, the New York Herald had this article. It warned...
Give me a microphone a little.
Okay. It warned that that dangerous animals were loose in the city, with casualties of 49 dead and 200 injured. Many readers panicked, even though at the end of the story, it stated that the entire story given is a fabrication. But, you know, people didn't read the whole thing, I get. The authors later claimed that their intent was merely to draw attention to the inadequate safety precautions at the zoo and claimed to be surprised at the extent of the reaction to their story.
Now, what is the date of this?
1874.
Okay, because one of the issues that we're going to talk about today is the problems in zoos and the lack of safety and care and the changes that people have tried to make in the last probably 50 years to make the zoos healthier places all around, both for the visitors and for the animals.
Yeah, remember that Orson Welles show, War of the Worlds?
Yes.
Where people panicked and thought it was real?
Well, that's what it sounds like.
Okay, so, before they were called zoos, they were called menageries.
Right.
And that changed... In England, anyhow, in the 1800s also, they had the London Zoological Gardens where they had animals. And the word zoo comes from the Greek, which means animal, and logos, which means to study.
Okay.
Like zoology. All right? And if we go back in history... Zoos were much less humane than they are today, or menageries, they were called in the old days. So there's a long history of zoos and menageries going back to royalty or wealthy people way back in time.
What was the first zoo, do you know?
Well, it was in Egypt, and it was in the 3,500 that they have...
The record of it?
Yeah, they dug up the site.
Right.
And it was in Egypt... And the animals that they found bones of were hippos, hartebeests, which are like wildebeests,
right,
and elephants, baboons, and wildcats. So, and then the Chinese were big on zoos. One of the Chinese emperors, Tangi, had a house of deer built. He had like a deer farm, and King Wen kept a 1,500-acre zoo. Now, that's pretty large.
That's huge, because we said the Bronx Zoo was 265 acres, and that was huge.
Yeah, so this was probably like the safari parks that they have now.
Right.
Where there was plenty of room. The animals were out almost in the open.
Right.
Which is very nice. So King Solomon had a zoo.
Well, 1,500 acres. I'm just trying to think about the size. Central Park is 846 acres, so it's almost double the size of Central Park.
Right, so it's a big area.
And it's a private zoo.
That was
a private zoo.
Yeah. Okay. Other well-known collectors were King Solomon of Israel and Judah in those days, King Semiramani, and King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon. So it was the thing to do. If you were rich or a king or a monarch and all that, you had a private zoo.
Right.
And maybe the regular people got to see it once in a while.
Right. We mentioned Rothschild Zoo in England, although that was later, but early 1900s.
Alexander the Great is known to have sent animals that he found on his military expedition back to Greece.
Right.
And the Roman emperors kept private collections of animals for study or for use in the arena. So I'm going to talk about that now. It's not a very nice chapter in the history.
No, but we have to.
I think I should cover it.
Right.
Okay. The 19th. Well, a historian wrote this description of the Roman Games, first held in the year 366 BCE. This is when they opened the Colosseum up.
Okay.
At one time, a bear and a bull, chained together, rolled in fierce combat across the sand.
Oh, my God. A bear and a bull.
Yeah. Wow. 400 bears were killed in a single day under Caligula. Okay, under Nero, 400 tigers fought with bulls and elephants.
Wow.
In a single day, at the dedication of the Colosseum by Titus, 5,000 animals perished. Lions, tigers, elephants, rhinos, hippos, giraffes, bulls, and stags, and even crocodiles and serpents were employed to give novelty to the spectacle. You know, the Colosseum are big circuses. They put on shows with gladiators and with animals fighting each other, and then people fighting animals. So that was a sad chapter.
It's amazing if you think about it.
I mean,
what would they? How would they have done that? They would have probably have to starve the predators, right?
To get them to fight.
Otherwise, the animals would be frightened in a setting like that. It's so unnatural. You'd think they would just go to a corner and hide.
Yeah,
but to have all of that carnage, they must have done something to get them to attack.
Yeah. So that wasn't a good early history of zoos and menageries. But things have changed now, luckily. But I just want to mention some other things in the history, Carol, that I'll just skip to because I have a lot here.
Well, okay. Tell about that Chinese zoo. You're talking about
horrible stuff. That's
2007.
Yeah, but I'll get up to that in a minute. I just want to talk about human beings in a zoo-like environment. Okay. Human beings were sometimes displayed in cages with non-human animals, supposedly to illustrate the differences between people of European and non-European origins. In September 1906, William Hornaday, director of the Bronx Zoo in New York, with the agreement of Madison Grant, head of the New York Zoological Society, had Ota Benga, a Congolese pygmy, displayed in a cage with chimpanzees, then with an orangutan. To show, the exhibit was intended as an example of the missing link between orangutans and white men. It triggered protests from the city's clergymen, but the public flocked to see it. So there's a long history of people and animals. And even as late as 1958, there was a Congolese village displayed at Expo 58 in Brussels.
Yeah.
But that wasn't as bad as having animals. This was just a typical village from the Congo.
Right.
So, luckily, things have changed, and now the facilities are getting better and better for the animals. But I just want to read you one more thing that's pretty bad. Okay. Oh, yeah, there are these roadside zoos that you find, especially in Florida and other places.
Right.
And some of them, there are no regulations controlling them, so they can do whatever they want. Some of them are really bad and run down. But there's a very nice one in Pennsylvania called Reptile World in western Pennsylvania. That supplied the Museum of Natural History with its reptiles and amphibians.
Oh, okay.
The frogs that we have, the poison dart frog exhibit.
Right.
And the we had a snake exhibit years ago with reptiles.
Yes, yes.
Remember that?
They came from there.
They came from Reptile Land. So I would recommend that place. It's called Reptile Land, and you could look it up online. That's a very nice private one.
A lot of the other ones are transient, too. That you when we did for the butterfly book, we tried to list all of the little exhibits all over the country, and a lot of them were not there. And then I traveled to some of them to see what they were like, and it also
and they were gone,
it wasn't there, or it was like very, very minimal.
Yeah. So we've got to talk about the children's zoos. There's also a children's zoo.
I'm afraid your microphone is by your ear instead of move the microphone.
Yeah, children's zoos, which are petting zoos. And there's one in Central Park, and I think in Queens, too, there's a farm zoo. Staten Island, I don't know anything about.
I've seen recently with my grandchildren, they have petting zoo, petting aquariums, where you can pet rays, which is very weird. I'm sure that that's not an accredited, I won't even mention where it is. There is the Association of Zoos and Aquariums that accredits zoos and displays now. And has standards by which they must operate. But this was really disgusting. This was a pool. This was just this year. It was a big circular pool, and all these grubby kids were around it reaching their hands in. There was a sign that said you should only pet them with two fingers, but it's full of these rays.
These rays, right.
And the kids are touching them and petting the rays. The water didn't seem very clean. Mm. And then they had those dispensers of alcohol to clean your hands afterwards. So you cleaned your hands afterwards, but God knows what got in there with the rays. Yeah, yeah, it was really so gross. I was very surprised that they would have something like that.
Yeah, these rays are not poisonous. They do have a barb that can stick in you, but not when they're swimming around in a circle.
Yeah, like no, those are not.
I remember seeing that somewhere, too.
Yeah.
So Florida has a lot. They have Busch Gardens in Florida, Disney's Animal Kingdom.
Right, and this was in Florida.
Yeah, and in other countries, too. So, and now we have the safari rides where you can stay in your car and ride through the safari park and see the animals out in the big habitat, which I guess is a
They've been doing that for a long time, because I remember they opened that one in New Jersey.
Yes.
Long time ago.
Is
probably
it Six Flags or something?
Yes, yeah, something like that. I remember going to it when it first opened. It was very interesting.
Yeah. So in modern zoos, about 5 animals are bred in captivity for every 20 animals on display. Okay, when they arrive at the zoo, the animals are placed in quarantine. All right? This is assuming they got them from the wild.
Right.
All right? Which seeks to mimic their natural environment. For example, some species of penguins may require refrigerated enclosures. That's what the Central Park Zoo has. It's terrific. And guidelines on necessary care for such animals is published in the International Zoo Yearbook. So there is a guidebook for zoos on how to treat different animals.
Right. Well, there are animal husbandry manuals for different animals, even animals like hummingbirds, which are very difficult to keep in captivity. If we have time, I'll talk more about that. But there's a husbandry manual that's been written in this country by the people from the Arizona Sonoma Desert Museum.
Yes.
And somebody from another museum worked with it. And then there also is one in Europe for hummingbirds. And so I think for each animal, probably, there's a special focus on all of the special needs and the best practices for taking care of them.
Yeah, I understand it's difficult with hummingbirds, that they're very difficult to raise in captivity and keep them happy.
Well, they're difficult. First of all, they're very aggressive.
Yeah,
they're
territorial.
Right, and you can't keep them with other birds.
Yeah.
Second of all, they eat an enormous amount. And because they burn up so much energy flying and just keep their normal style. They don't just sit and sleep. They move a lot, and they take, because they're so small, they can only take in a certain amount of nectar at a time.
Yeah.
And they feed they need hundreds of insects a day, and they need lots of nectar. So they're high maintenance just in terms of feeding them. You can't have an artificial feeder and easily satisfy them. And then if anything goes wrong with them, by the time you see that something's wrong, it's too late in most cases to take care of them, because there's almost no way to treat them.
Mm-hmm.
If you think about it, you can't take a blood sample because their veins are so tiny. It's almost unheard of to take a blood sample. If they break a wing, it's impossible to set because they're so small.
So delicate. Yeah.
And then if you have to medicate them, the only way to medicate them is to put the medication in with the nectar or in some kind of a nectar substitute, and then you have no way of dosing them.
Mm.
You can't judge how much of the medication they can take in. So that's just a great example of how complicated it is to take care of an animal, even if you have healthy ones. If you have healthy hummingbirds and you have plenty of plants and bugs, you still have all kinds of difficulties.
Mm. Yeah, so, you know, there are a lot of problems. But the good news is that zoos are getting better and better at keeping animals and taking care of them. So I have a few more things about problem zoos.
I was just going to talk about an elephant breeding program, since we're talking new kinds of zoos. I don't know, we're back and forth between problems and new kinds of zoos.
Right.
So there are a lot of interesting things to talk about. They have an elephant breeding program in Laos called Elephant Asia, and it's a new type of tourist attraction. They have a hospital and a laboratory, and the goal is to raise the birth rate of these endangered Asian elephants. And so they make it a medical facility so that people who own elephants will be encouraged to breed their elephants. And it also has a tourist element to it. Here goes the noise again. In that they have an observation tower that the tourists can climb, and it says to watch the cows interacting with their calves, but, you know, to watch all sorts of behavior.
Yeah, it sounds like a good
So that
good
sounds
do,
interesting
yeah.
as right. another type of, it's kind of a combination rehab facility like you described in Florida, where you're
right.
watching it through video cameras.
Mm-hmm.
And a tourist attraction at the same time, a breeding facility and a tourist attraction. So
yeah.
that's one new model.
Okay, so I'll talk some more about the negatives, and then you could talk about the positives.
Right. Well, don't. And how I don't know where we are. I want you to make sure to tell the story about feeding about the Chinese one.
Yes,
where
I
they,
will.
You know the one I mean.
Yeah, we have 2 minutes on this first
okay.
half.
Okay. All right.
So you want me to do the Chinese zoos now? I could do that. Okay. Let me find that. That was a very interesting thing. Let's see.
Well, I'll, while you're looking
Go
for
ahead.
It, I'll say in zoos now, you can often buy pellets for like a quarter. They have a machine, like a gum machine, and you put a quarter in and you get a handful of pellets, and then you can feed animals that aren't dangerous, right? So
right.
That this in certain types of animals will come over and feed
sure.
out of the child's hand.
That's like the petting zoos. The children's zoos have
right.
a lot of that, which
right.
is a great idea.
Mm-hmm.
Because those animals aren't going anywhere. It's a lifetime position they have at the zoo.
Right.
And they're going to stay there.
And I don't know how that's considered either, because you're not there's no control over the amount of food that they're taking in. It's also a very unhealthy balance for the animals to be constantly begging for these pellets that
yeah.
they can eat in great quantities if it's a busy day and there are a lot of kids feeding them.
Yeah, that's
and that
true.
Doesn't sound, it sounds like you'll have an obesity problem in a zoo like
yeah.
that, right? But Bernie has a better one.
Okay, live feeding. All right, so in this safari park in China, zoo visitors can throw live goats into the lion's enclosure and watch them being eaten.
This is from 2007.
Yeah.
Okay.
Or can purchase live chickens tied to bamboo rods for the equivalent of $2 to dangle into the lion's pens. So you can sort of tease them with the chickens on a bamboo rod like you're fishing. Visitors can drive through the lion's compound on buses with specially designed chutes leading into the enclosure, into which they can push live chickens.
Unbelievable.
From the bus. It has a chute where at each seat.
Right.
So you can push the chickens in the enclosure.
Incredible.
Okay, and then there's a bear and tiger mountain village in China where live cows and pigs are thrown to tigers to amuse visitors. Okay, and the last one I'm going to talk about, because it's enough already. In this other zoo, visitors engage in tortoise baiting, where tortoises are kept inside small rooms with elastic bands around their necks so that they can't retract their heads. Visitors then throw coins at them. The marketing claim is that if you hit one of them on the head and make a wish, it will be fulfilled.
I think we need a break.
Yeah.
Having just come back from the Galapagos Islands where I saw all these beautiful tortoises in the wild, this is pretty horrible.
Okay, we're going to take a break now and come back with some positive things in zoos now. And other things. No more killing live critters.
This program was sponsored by White Oak Pastures. The Harris family has lived and farmed White Oak Pastures for 145 years. They are committed to sustainable land stewardship and humane animal stockmanship. Their mission? We take care of the land and the herd, and they take care of us. For more information about their cattle and their farm, visit whiteoakpastures.com.
Okay, here we are back in the on the air, the naturalists, Carol Butler and Bernie Wise. And we're not going to talk about those facilities now, because in the United States, we have regulations for zoos and safari parks now, and we don't have any of that kind of stuff going on. There are about 10 different agencies that take care of animals and zoos. Okay, starting from the Endangered Species Act, the Animal Welfare Act, the Migratory Bird Treaty, and others. And zoos in North America can get accreditation by the Association of Zoos and Aquariums. Right, right, Carol?
Yep.
To achieve this, a zoo must pass an application and inspection process and meet or exceed the AZA standards for animal health and welfare, fundraising, zoo staffing, and involvement in global conservation efforts.
I think that our exhibit in the museum is accredited by them.
Oh, yeah, the butterfly.
By AZA, our butterfly exhibit.
Mm-hmm. So inspection is performed by three experts, typically one a veterinarian, one expert in animal care, and one expert in zoo management, and then reviewed by a panel of 12 experts before accreditation is awarded. Mm-hmm. So it seems like we really have it under control now. So this is repeated once every 5 years.
Right, right.
So the AZA estimates there are approximately 2,400 animal exhibits operating under their licenses in the United States. This is from 2007.
Right. And you wonder how many are not under their auspices.
There are a lot of them that are not
accredited. I'm sure a lot that aren't,
Okay, so you want to talk a little about conservation of the animals or...
Well, look, go ahead with the history. I want to talk about breeding programs have time. If we have time.
Okay. So I just wanted to mention about theme parks, which are like Marine World and SeaWorld. Which are terrific facilities, but you often wonder whether their primary goal is breeding these animals or putting on a show.
Right.
And what's the treatment supposedly is very good about training the animals. In the old days, they didn't have any regulations, so they could beat them and whip them and whatever they had to do. But today, everything is we hope, is fairly under control. And I was just going to talk about a friend of mine, Henry Kaplan, who's a veterinarian.
Mm-hmm.
And I did a show with him sometime last year. But he was a veterinarian at the Catskill Game Farm. He was the alternate veterinarian. And the Catskill Game Farm is a game farm up in the Catskills, which is very nicely done. Henry said he was impressed by how well they took care of their animals. And the animals are free and a free range.
Mm-hmm.
And you walk through it. And, you know, there are no tigers or lions or bears, but they're all the other big animals, giraffes and wildebeests, you know, and ruminants, which are like cow-like animals and a lot of animals like that. And he said that there was a vet on call there all the time.
Right.
And if there's something wrong with one of the animals, they would isolate it. And they had a whole facility there, like a little hospital, where they would check out the animals and make sure that they were okay. If there was something wrong with them, they put them in quarantine to take good care of them.
Mm-hmm.
So that was good to hear about, that those things are going on, right? And did I mention Reptile World? I think.
Why don't you go ahead?
Yeah. These are the
yes, the one in Pennsylvania.
Yeah,
you did mention. Yes, you talked
about
that.
Yeah, that's a very nice one.
Right.
Okay, so there's a dispute that goes on all the time, and you know the organization PETA, P-E-T-A,
right?
Which is their role is to take care of animals and make sure that they're not abused and all that. And they're against the zoos. They think the animals should be out in the wild or wherever they belong.
Right.
All right. But animals that breed frequently, such as deer, tigers, and lions, you know, sometimes you have too many animals. What are you going to do with them? I mean, the zoos can't take care of all the animals that they breed.
Right. This is a consequence of having better accommodations and more natural habitats so that there's more breeding that goes on.
And success in breeding.
Right.
So, you know, there's a listing of an animal finder's guide.
Right.
That's put out every year. It's a publication that it goes to zoos.
And what does it contain?
It contains animals that are available.
Extra animals that have been, that the zoos don't need, but that were conceived in the zoos.
Right.
Huh.
So they have a newsletter which the owners of hunting ranches post notices of sales and auctions, animals that they don't want or don't need anymore. So they, like they said that one of the writers that I quote here is that many hunters prefer killing animals from zoos or these safari farms than in the wild, because the trophies look better.
Right.
They're taken care of better, and they're in great tip-top condition. Mm. And
so how does that work? You have they probably have hunting facilities, and they buy deer from the excess,
yeah,
and let them roam in these facilities, and then people pay to come and shoot them.
That's right. And they get a license,
yeah,
and they hunt them and they shoot them. In Africa, they have it too. In Africa, you can go shoot a rhino, which are endangered species, but they may be doing. When I was in Botswana, the guy told me about that there were these game farms,
right,
and it's for hunting. They're hunting preserves. So in the United States, we don't have that, but we have big hunting areas,
yeah,
you know, open to the public.
Wow.
But it's a little different.
Right.
So if you're against killing animals, you know, the surplus animals are a big problem, because right, if they can't sell them to any zoos or anything, they use them for feed, you know, for the other animals.
Hmm.
Because what else are they going to do,
right,
with them?
Yeah. So it's such a paradox, right? If you make the environment too healthy,
right,
you end up with a surplus of animals, and that becomes a problem.
Right.
It's like with horses out in the West, the Mustangs, they have the areas that are preserved for the horses, for wild horses. We have, I think, a number of states out West. I don't remember. I want to say 11, but that's probably too many. And what happens is they have too many horses.
Yeah.
The horses are running free. They're very comfortable. Nobody's hunting them. They're not allowed to hunt them. And so they reproduce, and they are overrunning with horses. There are more horses than are allowed in the areas, and we don't slaughter horses anymore.
Yeah, so what are we going to do with them?
They have auctions for the excess horses.
People who want to buy a horse.
And it's hard to get rid of them. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, they have surplus lists, as I mentioned.
Yeah.
And they're sold to, you know, these farms, to circuses, animal merchants, auctions, pet owners, and game farms. So that's what they do with the extra animals. Okay? So there are statistics about how many animals, you know, go to these dealers, which use them for hunting.
Mm-hmm.
And there are unaccredited zoos that will do things that nobody knows what they're doing, really. So the whole goal is to get them all accredited and really control all of the zoos in the United States and probably in Canada and stuff like that.
Well, in the world. So, I mean, Europe,
the
there's a whole,
yeah,
European accrediting,
right, same
organization,
thing,
same thing.
I'm sure the EU has this problem too.
Right.
Yeah. So that's the downside of zoos. And also, once an animal is in the zoo, if it's exposed to humans, and they can never be released into the wild. All they can do is really send them to these game parks and safari parks and places like that, which they're nice for visitors to go to. But then the ethical question is, are the zoos to entertain visitors, or are they for scientific research and breeding of animals? And this battle goes on all the time.
Right, right.
Because you see that the zoos make their money by being open to the public and even putting on animal shows.
Right.
Right. When I was in, I think it was in North Carolina, I went to a zoo that put on an animal show. It was very good. They had a raptor do its thing and flying at the food, and then they had,
right,
a badger and all that. And it was very nice, but
right,
what's the treatment of the animals,
right,
to get them to do all this?
Well, I was just at Gatorland in Florida,
yeah,
which is the same thing. Part of it is sort of a swamp that you walk over or ride a little train over, and you see the alligators in their natural habitat, but they also have shows. They have, you make me think of the chickens in China,
yeah,
they have something hanging from strings, and the show, people yell and make a lot of noise, the people conducting the show, and they hang these strings with some kind of food item on the bottom of the string, and they have the alligators jumping to get the food, and people, and they make a big tumult out of it, you know, which one jumps higher and everybody yells. It was really horrendous.
That goes back to the old circus days in the Colosseum. We've changed, but
but not.
We don't kill animals on the mass scale like the Romans did.
Right.
But it's still, you know, it's still show times.
Right.
So, but modern zoos are... If you have to have zoos, they're doing it the right way now.
Right. Well,
and everybody everybody doesn't love a zoo, but most people like to take their children to zoos because it's a chance to see the animals, and they have all these nursery stories about animals and all that. So,
right.
It's you know, it's a mixed bag.
Right. And another function that some of the zoos where they have a more of a research orientation have focused on is captive breeding.
Right.
Which is something that's done in rehabs and universities too, but sometimes if you're working with bigger animals, it really needs to be done in a zoo. They're trying to modify the techniques to breed killer whales and tigers, and they save the gametes in liquid nitrogen just like they do with humans, and they have variable success with different kinds of animals using frozen embryos and frozen sperm and artificial insemination. But there are the most famous program that we have talked about before is when the falcons, peregrine falcons, were almost eliminated because of DDT, because the prey that they ate would have been contaminated, and so they were dying. They began captive breeding programs upstate
at New Paltz.
At New Paltz, right.
Yeah.
Peter, my co-author on the Raptor book, was involved in that. And they did. They also had one in Canada where they would had a captive breeding program for the raptors.
So that's a positive thing.
That's very positive. And that was a very successful program.
Yeah, for endangered species.
Right.
Sure. And even the other raptor programs. I mean, we have raptors now at home in New York City because of some of these breeding programs.
Right.
Right?
Right.
Especially the red-tailed hawks and the peregrines.
Right.
They were doing peregrines, weren't they, at New
Yes, Park? Yes.
Yeah, I remember we went up there one of the early days, and they had released the peregrines, and they were living in the bell tower on the campus.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, and they even do in vitro fertilization, implanting embryos in receptive females of endangered species. Mm-hmm. So that's interesting. I mean, there's all kinds of work going on. We've written about it. I mean, this area is called animal husbandry, whole field, right? And I couldn't find, it's from the Middle English. The word is from the Middle English. It means breeding, animal husbandry, breeding and raising animals. And husbandry also refers to plant husbandry.
Right, nurserymen.
It comes from, the word is from the Middle English around 1300. But all I could find is the Middle English word, which is housebundry.
Housebundry. Oh.
But I don't know what that means. I couldn't get a better definition. And this notion of caring for animals breeding them first began with domestic animals, and the earliest evidence, sort of interesting, was probably with sheep, which were the first animals that were domesticated. And this was from, the first evidence is from about 9,000 BCE in northern Iraq. Because I remember, I think in the horse book, I remember reading about this. How did animals get domesticated?
Right.
Ever happen?
Yeah.
Who did it first?
Yeah.
And the thinking is that it probably was sheep were relatively easy to domesticate. And so people who hunted and were nomads in a lot of it began in the steppes in Russia.
With the herders, I guess.
Right.
Yeah.
And they discovered that they could herd these animals, and then they could pen them in and have them to get through the winter so they'd have animals to eat. And that at some point they discovered that horses also could be domesticated, because you think of wild horses. But they learned learned some of the elements of domestication on sheep and goats and then on cattle and then on horses.
Right. That was a big step up for man. when they settled down to agriculture and domesticating animals.
Right.
They had a food supply.
Well, it was even before they settled down because they had herds,
as you said.
So they would take their herds with them.
Right.
And then as long as there was grazing land, I mean, some animals are better than others in the cold weather. Horses are very tough and can graze, they can be outdoors if it's really cold. Other animals have to be sheltered. So they learned all that. Imagine sort of evolving all that. All of a sudden you find all your sheep are dead because you had a cold snap one night.
But those horses that were living in Siberia in those places, they had long fur coats, right?
Yes, they have all different...
To survive the winters.
Right, they were certainly well equipped.
So if you remember the story of Antarctica, when Scott brought horses along, they had to put blankets on the horses.
Yes.
The horses froze to death.
Right.
Because they don't have that heavy fur coat that the wild horses used
to
have.
That's right. And also, there's always been that kind of... We can talk about horses a lot. There were always conflicts because... Some of these expeditions, the horses were the only food they had left. But because they're domesticated, there was resistance to using them as food.
That was the English on this expedition.
They took ponies. Sure. Some of the expeditions took ponies along, knowing they were going to use them as a food supply when the food ran out. But in others, they didn't want to eat them because it was like eating your pet,
eating your dog
or something.
Well, if you're really hungry, you'll eat your pet dog,
you
too.
You would think, right.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, let's wrap this up on a positive note.
Okay.
That zoos are getting better and better, and more humane.
Right.
And if they're well run, they're great places to visit, especially with your children or kids or you and all that.
And you should.
There are great zoos all over the United States.
And you should probably ask if you're considering going to a zoo, ask if it's accredited by the AZA. Because they're the ones who in this country are really trying to keep the standards up. And so it's important that we encourage the zoo owners to seek accreditation if they're not accredited.
Yeah. Right. I just want to show you the lengths that the Central Park Zoo goes. I talk about that one since I work in the park. Mm. Oh, by the way, the Central Park Zoo is in Central Park, but it has nothing to do with the rest of the park. It's run by the Wildlife Conservation Society.
Right, right.
And the park itself is the Parks Department of New York City and the Central Park Conservancy, which has made the park beautiful.
Okay.
So the other thing, what was I going to... Oh, the penguin exhibit.
Yes.
The lengths they go to in that exhibit to keep those penguins happy.
Mm-hmm.
What they do is they circle the day and night circadian rhythm.
Right.
Dark and
light. Dark, right.
Is... the same rhythm as if they were in Antarctica.
Oh, cool.
So, because they breed at a certain time.
Yes,
right as the days start to get longer, that's when they'll breed so they can lay their eggs when it's light out.
Right.
So they even go that far to
have the circadian rhythm reversed so that it's suitable. It's from their original habitat.
Right.
That's pretty interesting.
If you go there at certain times of the year, the lights can be very dim. And you ask them, you know, why is it so dim?
Right.
They say, well, this is wintertime in Antarctica.
Right, interesting.
So they do that.
Right. Well, and that's something that is also in exhibits. We do it in the butterfly exhibit, right? The lights are dimmed at a certain time because people ask us that. Visitors always ask, do you turn the lights out at night?
Yeah.
And we also try to keep the circadian rhythm normal.
And keep some of the moths happy that are in there.
Right, right. All right, I think we need to end.
Jack, I think we're going to wrap it up in a minute. And
I hope the background noise hasn't been too distressing.
Thanks for listening, in spite of all that jackhammering going on in the background.
Right.
And
this is The Naturalist, and we will be back again soon.
Right.
Let's go to the zoo. Let's go to the zoo. There are alligators at 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 the zoo. Let's go to 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 the zoo. There are elephants at 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 the zoo. Let's
for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.